Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Ken Miller. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Miller is an oncologist specializing in pain and palliative care. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Dr. Miller is joined by Dr. Evelyn Chatil. Dr. Chatil is the head of cognitive science for CogniFit, a company dedicated to learning techniques to enhance the functions of the brain. Dr. Chatil joins us to talk about chemobrain, a term used to describe memory lapse during and after treatment with chemotherapy.
Evelyn, let's start out, if you would tell us a little bit about your background in cognitive research and about CogniFit.
In the past, I used to work as a learning disability expert at the University of Haifa in Israel. And at that time, I was interested in the formation of long-term memories and in attention processes in children. And what we studied then was the fact that otherwise healthy and intelligent children were not capable of successfully forming memories, okay? And they could not acquire very basic skills, such as simple arithmetic facts or word reading skills. And later, I became interested in the retention of memories and preservation and maintenance and in attention and executive processes, but in the way we use them and retain them. So actually, this has brought me to our present subject of chemofog. And this is how I became interested in this phenomenon.
Well, you know, along those lines, let's go back a little bit because, you know, thinking about children who have problems with learning, tell us a little bit more, what does executive functioning mean?
Oh, okay. Executive functioning, I think, is our ability to manage mm-hmm. our cognitive processes. I will say it more simply. It's almost our ability to manage our lives, to manage what I think if you want to understand it, you have to think about being able to see what will happen. There is a lot of prediction, mm-hmm. a lot of thinking, of predicting, of hypothesis making. For example, you think, okay, if I want to invite this couple, are they going to talk to this couple? Mm-hmm. So whom am I going to invite? It's not just I am going to have a party on the 17th, but it's being able to look into the future. Actually, it's being able to go into quite a lot of details. In other words, it's planning.
Okay.
It's planning. It's being flexible in your planning. It's being able to change your original thought as you are planning because you have identified a problem. It's even being able to monitor what will happen, not only as it is happening, but even in the future. You anticipate either a problem or you anticipate a success, and then you continue acting according to what you anticipate. So executive functioning is actually quite going into the future.
Now, it sounds like, you know, some young people have this as a problem sure. when they're students. But can this, you know, tell us a little bit about what is chemo brain or chemo fog?
Okay. Chemo brain and chemo fog are interchangeable terms. And actually, I think they were invented by people who had undergone chemotherapy treatment or even just cancer treatment. And this is the term they used to describe what they were experiencing. And as usual, they came upon the right term because it is self-explanatory. You know, you think about a fog in your brain. You think about a brain that is not very clear. And doctors and researchers have adopted the term, and it's become very well-known and well-referred term.
So along those lines, I mean, what are the symptoms? I mean, what would make someone say to their doctor, "Oh, I've got chemo fog"?
Well, there are a few symptoms, okay, and most of them are related to people experience problems in memory or in attention. For example, a lot of patients report not being able to find the right word in a conversation, especially in a spontaneous conversation. What I mean by spontaneous, one that hasn't been planned ahead, not like a job interview, but where you may rehearse your answers, but just a conversation where you're groping for the right word. Now, every one of us gropes for the right word from time to time. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a normal thing. But the people after the people who are undergoing treatment report many instances of this kind of difficulty, mm-hmm. many more than they were used to before they had the illness. So that's one instance. The short-term memory mm-hmm. problems are very common in the report of the patients. Okay, they sit with the doctor and they say, "I could not remember why I went into the next room." You know, you're in the middle of doing something and you realize you have forgotten your pen or whatever it is you have forgotten, and you go into the next room, and you do not understand, or you do not know why you went into the next room. And even this happens to a lot of people, sure. but it happens many more times. The instances are fewer mm-hmm, when mm-hmm. you haven't been sick. So
let me ask you, does it affect, some of these are memory and word finding. How about, you know, we had talked a little bit about executive function. Is that affected?
Yes. I think it's very much affected. I think it's one of the common complaints, and I think it's also a little bit frightening for the person, because our life is very complex, and we are always involved or doing something that looks very simple, but it's a multitask. You know, we have to do several things at the same time. We have to divide our attention among several little tasks. For example, you could be talking on the phone and you have to remember that you need to leave in another 2 minutes to pick somebody up. And at the same time, you need to remember not to forget to turn off whatever is cooking, or if it's, you know, if somebody's at home, or if you are at work, you need to forget not to make this very important call phone before you leave. So the multitasking, which requires a lot of divided attention, a lot of splitting your attention and being aware of what is going on in every single little part of your task is important. So this is why I think those complaints are more frequent mm-hmm, mm-hmm. when a person either returns to work or returns to some kind of fuller functioning, because his or her tasks become more complex and require more division of attention. And
do you as a scientist, or do we in general in medicine know what the mechanism is? I mean, how does chemotherapy or here's a question for you: is it really just the stress of having had cancer, or is it more of a physiological?
This is the $1,000 question. I mean, people have been thinking about whether there is researchers. Mm-hmm. causal relationship, whether chemotherapy is the cause and chemobrain is the result. They've been thinking about it since 1974, I think, mm-hmm. when the first studies started to come out. And as people started to research the problem, they realized, like everything else in our life, that there is no simple answer. Although, if we have the time, I will tell you what the research says today. But as you were hinting or suggesting, cognitive decline could occur due to a number of reasons that would have nothing to do with chemotherapy. For example, if you're stressed, and people who have very serious illness are stressed, or if you're depressed, we know depression is also associated with memory problems, cognitive problems, or fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
Fatigue. We know, for example, multiple sclerosis patients who are very fatigued also report cognitive decline. If you have a hormone fluctuation, some women, after chemotherapy, they suddenly go unexpectedly into earlier menopause, and then the hormone system, the hormone mechanisms change. And this also may affect your cognition, your ability to remember and manage your thinking. And so there are many, many possible factors. It's very hard for researchers to say today whether chemotherapy is the cause,
mm-hmm.
although the latest studies do point to chemotherapy as one of the possible causes. Also, we must mention, I think, that not everybody is affected by cognitive decline or cognitive problems.
Okay. Well, we'd like to remind you, our listening audience, if you have questions or things you'd like to share, you can email these to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can call 1-888-234-4YCC. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute, and then please stay tuned to learn more information about chemo brain, chemo fog, and cognitive problems with Dr. Evelyn Shatil.
It's estimated that over 2 million men in the U.S. are currently living with prostate cancer. 1 in 6 American men will develop prostate cancer in the course of his lifetime. Major advances in the detection and treatment of prostate cancer have dramatically decreased the number of men who will die from the disease. Screening for prostate cancer can be performed quickly and easily in a physician's office using 2 simple tests, a physical exam and a blood test. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for prostate cancer. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to experimental medicines not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Well, welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm very happy and privileged to be here with Dr. Evelyn Shatil, who's from Israel and is a researcher doing work on chemo brain and chemo fog, and something that she refers to as cognitive rehab. Evelyn, let me ask you, are there certain groups of people who are being treated for cancer who seem to be more likely to have problems?
I think there are certain groups that report more problems. We are not sure they're the people who have more problems. For example, most of the problems were reported by women who had undergone, who had breast cancer, and they were reporting those problems to their doctors. And these were the large numbers. But if we think about what research is telling us, I am not aware of groups of people like more women than men, or actually I went to conferences where men stood up and told the audience about their own problems and not women.
Mm-hmm.
But the latest research tells us about a connection between the intensity of chemotherapy and the strength of the cognitive impairment, and between the duration of chemotherapy and the worsening of cognitive impairment. So what we know, and there was an important Dutch study done, what we know is that higher doses of medication will cause the fog to be more severe, will cause the problem to become more severe. And we also know that people who have had several cycles or 2 or 3 cycles of chemotherapy do not test as well on cognitive batteries, on cognitive neuropsychological tests as people who have had fewer cycles.
Right.
So, and there are studies to that effect.
Now what is the natural history? I mean, do most people improve? Do most people not get better?
Okay. The natural history is so that, first of all, I think it's quite optimistic because as time passes, people report fewer and fewer problems, okay? Sometimes they report problems that are so subtle when you use our own batteries, when you use our own, which may have limitations because our batteries were originally designed for other purposes, and normal people may actually experience a decline which the battery is not capable to capture, but the person is actually experiencing a subtle deterioration, and it's accented enough that the person knows and realizes that functioning is not as it used to be. So we also know that the drugs that were used, I think they're called CMF, that were used...
Mm-hmm. For breast cancer?
Yes. That were used... In the past, were more conductive to deterioration than the drugs that are used today. So these are very good news. But still, the number of complaint is not decreasing. Actually, we used to think, studies used to consistently report that from 10% to 30% of the patients would report and would score on neuropsychological batteries would score in such a way that it testifies to a problem. But some studies now are going as high as 45%. So
now I want to move on to a very important topic, which is, you know, your field, which is in a sense helping people sort of restore them, their functioning. What can we do for people with this?
Okay. I personally believe in an integrated view of life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as we were saying before, anything that will help a person to feel less depressed, to feel more relaxed, to feel happier, anything that that person knows works for him or her. I mean, it's not a recipe-giving thing. We know some people love to listen to music. Some people love to read. Some people love to go and visit their grandchildren. Everyone knows what makes them happy. So perhaps it's a time for introspection and for thinking about oneself and for thinking about what I want to do to make myself happier and to recover better, okay? Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. Now, where the brain is... where the brain is affected, of course, we know, you are the doctor, so you know more about drugs than I do, but from what I know, drugs are not really doing the job of restoring memory. I mean, we don't have the magic drug now. And I believe in cognitive rehabilitation. I believe in cognitive training. Otherwise, I wouldn't be...
So what does that mean? What is that?
It means that you stimulate your brain knowingly, consciously, and using tools that were designed for this purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And if I may, I want to explain the difference between a game and a cognitive training program. A game may be excellent for you. It may be fun. It may be joy-giving. And it may make you feel very competent because we know usually people go back to those games. They know how to play. And they go back to those games where they feel successful. And so you might select the games where that tap into the processes that are not really haven't been weakened. You might do this unconsciously. On the other hand, a cognitive training program, a good one, would start by evaluating your cognitive abilities. It would be done in a friendly way, but it would be done so that the program, knowing what your cognitive abilities are, would have a record of what cognitive abilities are in very good shape mm-hmm. and what cognitive abilities need strengthening mm-hmm. and sometimes what cognitive abilities, which ones need reconstructing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the program would then start working. But without a baseline, the program cannot build a tailored regimen of training.
So you're talking about, in a sense, a computer program that makes an assessment and then does what with it?
Oh, yes, exactly. I'm talking about home-based training. You can do it in the privacy of your home mm-hmm. at the time which suits you, whenever you want. And the computer, as you said, evaluates your abilities. And then, at least in our programs, there is a very complex mathematical algorithm at work to create a link between your results on the evaluation and the training you will get. Mm-hmm. And if I may, in our program at least, we made great effort so that the person would always be in the comfort zone. Mm-hmm. The mm-hmm. brain has got to be challenged. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's for sure. If the brain isn't challenged, if there isn't some effort, then the brain is not working and those synapses are not being created, those mm-hmm. new synapses. But the effort is the effort that you will be experiencing is based on what you can do, as opposed to any just program that is trying to catch some idyllic average and we don't know whether it exists or not. So
here's a question, maybe easier or hard. Does it work?
Okay, I will be very candid.
Okay.
We do not have research evidence regarding people who have undergone chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. We have anecdotal testimony, but this is not research evidence. We mm-hmm. have people who are very happy to have done it, who felt it has empowered them. We have research evidence with other populations, mm-hmm. okay, like multiple sclerosis people who have experienced cognitive decline due to a little bit brain, mm-hmm. a traumatic brain injury, or we have normal aging people who are 50 years and over. We have beautiful results from a study that has been carried out in a Tel Aviv Medical Center in Israel. We have beautiful results that are being published, that have been published. But regarding the effect of chemotherapy, what I would like to say, if I may,
sure.
What I would like to say is that my feeling is that it's one of the most promising avenues for treatment. It's fun. Mm-hmm, it's mm-hmm. Non-invasive.
Yeah, yeah.
And as you do the training, that's something everybody says and I've experienced, as you do the training and as you work and you say, oh my God, I'm working on my word-finding problem. Oh, this is attention. This is clearly a very interesting task of divided attention. So as you work, you know you're working on those problems that you were telling your doctor mm-hmm, mm-hmm, about. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a very good feeling, and it makes you aware that you're becoming self-sufficient, that you're doing something that is specifically geared to this problem you were experiencing.
Now, in some of the other fields where you've tested this, such as with aging or with multiple sclerosis,
yes.
Are some of the benefits, are they long-lasting?
Okay, I'll be honest with this. We do not know. Mm-hmm. That's a new product. It's been for years in the making. It's taken 5 years to do it in mm-hmm. such a way that it would be scientifically based and it would be tested. But lots of studies have been done, mm-hmm. and we know that programs that are not as systematic as ours, that are not as long-term as ours, mm-hmm. that are not as tailored and that do not give feedback as much as ours, have long-term mm-hmm. Gains. And other programs, there are some programs that only test the verbal module, We test all the modules, but and they have shown long-term results, even in affecting the quality of life of the people who've been using them. So we may generalize that cognitive rehabilitation, possibly and probably, is a good thing to do. Is something to do, and if
I have to say it does sound wonderful. I see many women with breast cancer, and people. Talk about that their thinking is not as clear and they're not as quick at word finding and sometimes even more significant problems. And how wonderful to be able to offer something other than a pill, medication, you know, or telling people to go do crosswords.
May I say last sentence?
Yes, of course.
The program we have is called Back on Track. Mm-hmm. And it's a cognitive training program that is working on those very abilities that are known to be impaired or that are known to be affected after you have had cancer and treatment and chemotherapy. So there is a lot of attention training there. There is a lot of word finding. There is a lot of planning, predicting, shifting, inhibition, which are executive functioning measures. So the name of the program is Back on Track. It's not MindFit, which is also another program we have.
Yeah, actually, I have to tell you, even the name I actually sort of like. Back on Track makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
Because when people, you know, in a sense, when you go through a cancer experience, it's feeling like you're off the track.
Oh, yes.
So it's bringing things around again. Where do you, just another question, with all the interest in science and in different scans that can be done on the brain, in this field in general, when you stimulate people's brains and do work like this, do we know what happens to the brain itself?
Yes. What happens to the brain is interesting. Most studies, there have been fMRI scans, and Professor Art Miller at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, for example, he has trained older adults. And the scans show that before training, several parts of the brain that were not usually active in the normal population, he was training older people, that the whole brain was active. It was like not a thrifty way of processing information. It was not economical. Mm-hmm, the whole brain was. And after training, there were some specific areas which we know are identified with that kind of processing that were activated. And actually, I think he's not the only one. There have been other studies. So there are two. So that's the main finding, that actually, if you stick to it, if you trick the brain into believing that it needs that skill, and how do you do that? You keep telling the brain, here, I need it, I'm doing it. Yes, divided attention, I need it, I'm doing it, I'm doing it, I'm doing it. And the brain says, oh my God, I've got to do it.
Right.
Because the brain is lazy. So after a while, after you stick to it and you don't give up, then you see that those areas in your brain have become active. So usually more synapses, I think, and I think you could have fascinating interviews here on this subject with people who are much more expert than I am.
I think this has been terrific, and I want to thank Dr. Evelyn Shatil, who is from Israel and is head of cognitive science for Cognifit, which is an organization that's really looking into rehab. Evelyn, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, and have a good day.
I just want to thank our audience for joining us. This has been a wonderful program. Until next week, this is Dr. Ken Miller from the Yale Cancer Center wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions, comments, or would like to subscribe to our podcast, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you'll also find transcripts of past broadcasts in written form. Next week, we'll meet Dr. Lynn Wilson, who will discuss radiation therapy.